Attention, men. Are you wanting to break free from porn or other unwanted sexual behaviors, but finding it seemingly impossible to quit? If so, we can help. My name is Jonathan Daugherty, the founder of Gateway to Freedom. This 3-day workshop is for any man who wants to overcome any kind of unwanted sexual behavior. So whether you're married, single, or divorced, this powerful and proven intensive weekend will help you uncover what is at the root of your struggle and discover the man God always created you to be. Space is limited, so call us today at 210-822-8201 to register. That's 210-822-8201, or visit bebroken.org/GTF. Good day, listeners. Jonathan Daugherty here with another edition of the Pure Sex Radio program. You know, we're a listener-supported outreach of Be Broken Ministries, and we exist to help individuals and families move from sexual brokenness to wholeness in Christ and equip others to do the same. You know, addiction recovery is hard work. It's the process of learning to live in a whole new way apart from old, harmful, compulsive patterns. And such transformation doesn't happen quickly or without help. Our guest today is Mark Dennison. He's been on the program several times before and is the co-founder with his wife Beth of There's Still Hope. He joins us to talk about his newest book, Recovery Rules, 100 Truisms That Will Change Everything. Men often need pithy, wise tips to help them on the long road of recovery. In our conversation, we highlight several of the truisms, such as, if you are 90% in, you are 100% out. Addiction isn't a bad problem, it's a bad solution. Or if you can stay sober for 20 minutes, you can stay sober. And relapse is not an event, but a process. Don't commit to a lifetime, commit to a day. And another one is direction trumps destination. So if you're looking for some super practical help for your recovery journey, this episode will be very impactful. To learn more about Mark and his ministry's resources, visit theresstillhope.org. For even more resources, visit bebroken.org or check out links in today's show notes. And of course, friends, we would sure love it if you would rate and review the program after listening to help others find it. Now let's go ahead and dive into today's excellent conversation with Mark. Well, all right, Mark Dennison, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jonathan. Always great to be with you.
Yeah, so we've had you on several times. I feel like every time we've had you on, you've written like 5 new books or workbooks or something. You're like a prolific, you know, resource machine down there in Florida. But for any of our new listeners or folks that maybe they haven't listened to some of the other podcasts that you've been on, can you share a little bit about who you are and then what you and your wife are doing through your ministry, There's Still Hope?
Yeah, I'd love to, Jonathan. Thank you. We're from Houston, Texas. I was a senior pastor for over 30 years and got into sexual addiction recovery in 2013. We moved to Florida after we left the pastorate in Texas and went back to school to get further training in this area. So we launched our ministry in 2017. It's called There's Still Hope. And what we provide is a lot of resources for couples. We do a weekly couples group based on a workbook that we've written for couples. And then Beth does one-on-one coaching for spouses that are getting through betrayal trauma. And I work with guys. I've got 9 groups right now that meet throughout the week. One is an in-person group, and then 8 groups that meet by Zoom. And we go through a workbook that I've written called The Life Recovery Plan. And you can jump in anytime. It takes a year to go all the way through the book. And we take 52 standalone topics that we unpack in our groups each week. Have 2 groups just for pastors, a group just for doctors, and the other groups are open for anybody. And all of this and our other resources can be found on our website, which is theresstillhope.org.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've stayed very, very busy in this ministry, and I'm looking forward to kind of unpacking what you've put in this latest book, because what I like about the design of how you've written this is you've got these recovery rules. And so first of all, tell us kind of the layout of the book, but also why did you feel this was an important book to write?
Well, it's I've been writing this book for 7 or 8 years without knowing it. Because what would happen, I don't know how you are, but for me, if I'm driving down the street and I hear something on a podcast or something that just comes to me, or I have a thought and it's maybe a different way of saying something, I just latch on to those things. It's like, as a pastor, I love John Maxwell's stuff because he had so many great sayings about leadership. And so I would just put them in my phone and write them in, just made a list of all these things I would think of that just kind of captured the essence of recovery. And eventually, after several years of that, the thought came to me, I ought to put these in the form of a real simple, easy to read book. And so I was going to do 20 rules of recovery, but I kept putting it off, and I thought of more, and I thought of more, and I thought of more, and the number kept growing. And when it got to 100, I decided last year, enough's enough. I can't keep playing with this. I've got to go ahead and write this now, because if I don't, it's going to be 1,000 rules, and no one's ever going to read it, and I'm going to be an old man. So I've got to go ahead and do something with this. And so it was 100 rules that I thought of just over the course of several years. If I were to rewrite it now, I'd probably take a few out, put some others in, because it's kind of a work in progress. And I always tell guys, when you read this, let me know your rules. Tell me the things that you know of, that you've heard, that you think are helpful. And so what we've actually done with it is I now send out a new rule every day by text. So if anyone reaches out to our ministry at thirststillhope.org and is interested, my email is mark@thirststillhope.org. I've got several hundred men that receive a daily recovery rule by text that goes out every morning at 10 Eastern time. So it started with me just looking for things that worked for me. And then as they grew, I thought maybe this could be helpful for some others. So I put it into the book.
That's great. Now, let's first of all just unpack that idea of a rule, because I think as soon as somebody hears that, they can go to, you know, law or just something that can be this burdensome yoke on the back, right? Can you unpack what you are actually trying to mean by this idea of recovery rules?
Well, I read a book a couple of years ago by my favorite author. It's something about grace-based recovery. And within the context of that, the author, who a good friend of yours, it's you, did such a good job of unpacking the role of grace in recovery and taking the shackles off and recognizing God's really for us. So the point of this is to find words of encouragement. It's not to be legalistic. It's just truisms would be a better word. But I'm an old pastor, so I like alliteration. So it had to be recovery rules. They both start with an R. But it's nothing legalistic. It's just a few things that are encouraging, that are helpful, that you can latch onto and say, that's something I can put in practice today. I come out of 12-step movement in my own recovery and still go to weekly SA group. And as you know, from the AA tradition, there are so many little statements, pithy statements have been out there forever. And so this is sort of my version of that.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, when you had sent me the manuscript to look over, as I was going through it, I was like, these read like proverbs, right? They're just these little wisdom statements that are saying, hey, you know what? I could chew on this probably for a month and not totally get the full meaning of everything that it could apply to my life. So I kind of, you know, I think as we go through this, we could use a lot of synonyms in terms of, is it a proverb? Is it a rule? Is it a truism? Yep. But the bottom line is, what do you hope that a man comes away with by actually latching on to some of these recovery rules?
My goal is that one out of every five or one out of every 10 resonate. So each one in the book takes, it's just 2 pages. So it literally takes 1 minute to read each one. And I know that no one is going to resonate with every one of them. But my prayer is that as guys open it up, they'll look at it and say, okay, there's one I can use. There's one I can use. Because you don't have to bog down so long in anything. And there are some that I've had a lot of guys tell me through my groups, man, rule number 16 was so powerful for me. And then I've got to grab the book and start thumbing through to see what that is because I don't know. And I'll look at it and I'll say, really? Because I thought that one was kind of weak, you know, whichever one that was. And so just finding those few nuggets that will be applicable to where that guy, whoever's reading it, happens to be in his journey right now.
Yeah. So obviously we're not going to have time to go through every single one of the 100 rules, but I thought we could maybe try to do kind of like a top 10, you know? Okay. So let's start going through, you had sent me beforehand some of what you had kind of almost outlined as, you know, some of the ones that you'd put sort of at the top. And then I've got a few more that I would want to add into that. So why don't we just go through, you know, one of the ones, rule number one that you have is if you are 90% in, you're 100% out. So walk us through what that even means.
John chapter 5, verse 6, Jesus said to the paralytic, "Do you really want to be well?" And the thrust of what he's saying is, are you desperate? Because recovery is something that has to be a lifestyle, not a hobby. And so if I make it a hobby and say, yeah, I think I'd like to dabble in recovery and maybe go to a meeting, maybe see a therapist occasionally, then I'm going to struggle. I've got to be all in. It's the one thing I know in life that if I'm not 100% in, I'm not going to find what I need. I'm not going to find sobriety, recovery, peace of mind. I'm not going to find the life that I want, my integrity. I'm not going to get that. And I know that because I did that for 30 years of my own life. I was 90% in. I didn't want anyone to know my secret. I didn't want to see a specialist over here. And so I dabbled. I did a lot of it, but didn't quite get over the hump. And so the hundreds of guys I worked through my groups over the last 7 years or so, the one consistency I've noticed is that guys that are only 90% in, they don't make it. If you're 90% in, you're 100% out. You're either all the way in or you're all the way out. It's sort of like in baseball. You and I are both baseball fans. Triples don't matter if you don't score. And right. We see that a lot of guys in recovery that hit a lot of triples. And they're standing on third base and everyone's cheering them on saying, man, that was a great hit. But if they don't get across the plate, it doesn't matter. And so they don't maintain long-term sobriety because there's something holding them back. It's Mark chapter 10, the rich young ruler, when Jesus said this one thing you lack. He didn't say you're messing up in a lot of areas. He said there's one area, that one thing that's holding you back. It's keeping you from achieving your goal. And so if whatever that 100% looks like for me and you and everyone's going to be a little different, my program's going to be a little different from someone else's. But I know for me and I know for others that if I'm only 90% in, I'm not going to get there. I'm not going to put any runs on the board. So I might as well be 100% out.
Yeah. And it's such a matter of the heart, right? It's not necessary. You know, when you mentioned the rich young ruler, hey, he had great stats, right? Probably had a bunch of triples, bunch of, doubles, but not, there was that one thing that was hindering him. We had a guy come to our workshop many years ago, and he actually used this very percentage. He said, I feel like I've come 90%, but I got to get that other 10%. And he was tapping into exactly what you're talking about here. He'd gotten to 90%, but he realized, you know, that's only passing in like English. You know, that's not actually what recovery is about. You got to put yourself all the way in. That's really good. You mentioned
a lot of guys that they've done really good recovery work, but when they went to one of your freedom weekends in Orlando or in Texas, that for them, that's what put them over that 100%. So totally agree with you.
Yeah. You say that rule number five is that addiction isn't a bad problem. It's a bad solution. So talk us through that one.
We tend to see any addiction, and the American Psychological Association, I think, has 166 of them on their latest tabulation. We see addictions as a bad problem. I've got to quit acting out. I got to quit drinking. An alcoholic called me yesterday, and his whole issue is alcohol. He said, "Can you help me with this?" Or someone has a gambling problem, or someone has a sex problem, whatever it is, whatever the addiction is. We always treat it as a problem. And when we do that, we end up attacking the behavior. So we have this thing that I've created that I call an addiction pyramid. There's four layers to it. The top layer is the acting out behavior. The second layer are triggers when I'm bored, lonely, angry, stressed, or tired. Beneath that, whatever feeds the trigger. Beneath that, there's pain, there's isolation, there's trauma, there's abuse. And so if we look at addiction, the behavior, and say that's the problem, then we're going to keep firing away at the top of the pyramid and we're attacking the fruit instead of the root. When I see it, the addiction is a solution to a deeper problem, I then start unearthing what is that deeper problem. I get down into the roots. I get down the dirt. I get my hands dirty to get down to the roots. But it's only when I do that that I start finding out, you know, I've got some insecurities that are driving this. I have an intimacy disorder that's driving this. I've got some trauma from my childhood. Maybe the guy that molested me sexually when I was 8 years old, that wasn't such a good idea. That didn't work out very well for me. This has created some trauma. And I've got to deal with those problems rather than just what I have created as my own solution. Because the sexual acting out for me and for every addict is simply a way to self-medicate. It's a way to cover up the pain of the problem, but it doesn't deal with the problem. And so if all we do is deal with addiction as a problem instead of a solution, we forget and we ignore what that real problem is. I've got to be willing to do the deep work of digging down and figuring out what's behind it.
That's good. I had Stephen Cervantes, one of my buddies and counselor friends and co-host on here. He said, you know, a good diagnosis is half of the solution. Yes. And so I think that's what you're talking about here. We've misdiagnosed porn as the problem when actually yes. it's just a bad solution. And so once you get that figured out, you're halfway home towards really getting, you know, the kind of healing and recovery that you need.
Absolutely.
You know, I love rule number 8. I can't wait for you to unpack it. You say, if you can stay sober for 20 minutes, you can stay sober. I love that. Tell us why that's true.
It's neurology. It's dopamine. It's neuropathways. It's all about that dopamine hit. When I have that sexual urge or whatever the dopamine hit might be, it could be some other addictive behavior. When that urge hits, it's a fantasy, a forced recall, a memory, a thought. I'm looking at someone attractive. I want to act out. I want to self-medicate. I want to masturbate. I want to turn to porn. I want to go online and look for a sexual partner. And that when that urge hits, if I can just stay calm, if I can stay busy, and in my book, 90 Day Recovery Guide, we talk about ways to do that over 20 minutes with things like thought replacement, pop and pray, get active doing something physical, get on a call, do something. For 20 minutes, the urge will pass because it's just a neurological thing. The peak of the dopamine rush passes within 20 minutes, give or take. It's not a hard and fast rule, but give or take 20 minutes, and then it comes down. So what happens is that guys, when they have that rush, they will tell me that, gosh, I'm like, oh, I got to act out right now. And if it takes them 20 minutes to do that, let's say that they have to remove themselves from where they are to go online and look for pornography, or they're going to go look for somebody someplace, that by the time they act out, it's anticlimactic because the rush has already passed. It happens in those first 20 minutes. And so if guys can just stay sober for 20 minutes, that rush, that peak, that urge is going to diminish and you can make it. And I've learned that, I've taught that, and I've heard that from so many guys that have said, Mark, that saved my bacon. The fact that if I could just get on the treadmill for 20 minutes or do something for 20 minutes, it didn't go away, but it became much more manageable.
Yeah, and I love that. And I think it's important, just some of the stuff you're talking about, even around neurobiology. Yes. Because, you know, sometimes I like to say that we're primarily composed of three parts. We have a spirit, a soul, and a body. Right. So there's the physical, there's the emotional, and then there's also the spiritual. And so many times what we've seen in recovery is somebody gets hyper-focused on only one part of who they are. So you have somebody really focused in counseling, just merely on the emotional part. You got somebody super focused in, you know, with a pastor on the spiritual part. And then you got maybe, this is the part that gets left off the most often, is maybe somebody goes and sees their doctor, maybe not. You know, the physical part is hardly ever addressed. And they wonder why the spiritual and the emotional is not transforming their whole life. So just as a little sidebar here, can you talk about why it is important for men to address the physical aspects of neurobiology as part of their recovery as well?
The simplest way I would answer that is that the biggest sex organ in the body is the brain. Even the optic nerve to the eye is part of the brain. It's part of the nervous system. And so when we take in those images, the brain is storing those. One of my recovery rules we probably won't get to today is about fantasy. The best way to shut down fantasy is quit creating new ones, because the brain stores every image. It stores these things. We're very visual beings. And so I can have 10 years of recovery and 10 minutes of visual recovery if I'm taking in these images. So the brain stores them. And so I've got to shut those down. The physiological part of it, the brain system, is so complicated. It stores videos, it stores visuals. And so I've got to learn to shut that down. If I ignore that and only focus on the spiritual or the emotional, then it's a three-legged stool. You've got to focus on all three.
Yeah. And I think it's important to be reminded that because of the beautiful reality of what's called neuroplasticity, mm-hmm. the brain is changeable in that sense. I think some people have felt like, I could never have different desires. I could never have different motivations. I could never have different thoughts. And God has so beautifully constructed even our brains that neural pathways can be rerouted and restructured. And so that's a beautiful part of recovery as well.
The brain that I have today is not the brain I had a year ago, and it's not the brain I'm going to have a year from now. And that's not just because of aging and cells that are dying off. I get to actually make a decision on what I feed that brain visually and other stimuli that will help create the brain that God wants it to be.
Yeah. So rule number 17, which I think could bring a whole lot of hope to a lot of guys that wonder if their past has any purpose. You say, God won't use you despite your past, but because of it. Unpack that for us.
When we got into this ministry, as you know, one of the first things we did is I came to see you because I wanted to talk to someone who had been working in this space for a number of years with a high success rate. And one of the things that I walked away from that restaurant, San Antonio, feeling in a very strong way was that I'd not been condemned, I'd not been judged. When I shared with you that I was a pastor, the things I'd done, the fall, the betrayal of my spouse who's there with me, we're still married after 40 years, it gave me a lot of hope. And so that's why we called our ministry, There's Still Hope, that God is not going to use me despite what I've done, but because of it. Another way to say that is that what God allows, God redeems. God didn't cause this, but he allowed this, and God will redeem this. I was a pastor for 30 years. To my shock, every church that I ever pastored when I left found another guy to pastor. That's shocking that that could even be possible. But, you know, the seminaries are pumping out a lot of preachers. Finding pastors is not hard. But finding men and women that work in this space is a whole nother deal. And so I still have the pastor's heart. I still work with guys from a pastor's heart. That'll never change. But God is using me now in ways that he never could have used me before. The churches have thrived after I've left, and we're able to do other things now that I never could have done. And so it's amazing. I never thought it was possible. But to see that God is literally taking what the enemy intended for evil and turning it for something good. And so whatever ministry I was a part of before, it's still thriving. It's doing great. But now we're doing this as well. And so we're seeing in a new space based on being real and transparent. That's something I never did as a pastor because of my personal struggles. Now I can be real. The secrets are out. We can help people in a whole new way that I never did before.
Yeah. And I feel like that's always just another evidence of God's grace, that he doesn't just rescue us out of our sin. He says, hey, you know what? I've got beautiful, wonderful work for you to do in my kingdom. Isn't that a whole nother layer of grace? It's one thing, the grace of rescue, but then the grace of purpose and you know, work to do, which is good.
Well, the old way we say in seminary was that God doesn't call the qualified, he qualifies the called. And so when God calls someone to ministry, he's going to qualify them. And I don't need anyone's approval but his. But it's an exciting thing to see that God will take someone off the trash heap, if you will, and say, I'm going to clean you up. I'm going to use you again in ways I never could have before. And so we feel like we're having more impact than we ever have in kingdom work. And for other guys, they may not be doing ministry like you and I do. And most of them are not going to do this sort of thing, but they can still help people. They can still get back and help in ways they never could have before. So my word of hope to every guy that's struggling is when you break through this, you find freedom. God isn't going to look at you and say, man, it's too bad he messed up most of his life. I can't use him. God's going to say, because I'm God, because I get the final word, then I'm going to use you in a way that I never could have before, and you're going to make a difference no one else could.
That's good. So rule number 19 to me reads a little bit like a kind of a little bit of a colloquial proverb. You say that free cheese is always available in the mousetrap. Help us understand that one.
Turns out we had a mouse in our attic. And turns out mousetraps really work, but the mice do not appreciate them very much. So knowing that we had a mouse up there, I did what any man would do. I sent my wife up into the attic with the mousetrap. And we didn't hear the mouse running around anymore. I did what any man would do. I sent my wife up to capture it. And it was dead. So here's what happens. The mouse sees the cheese, doesn't see the trap, goes for the cheese, probably enjoys it for a split second, and then it snaps its head off. And so for us, in terms of addictive behavior, the enemy's always going to have plenty of free cheese out there. I can find video stimuli. I can find a woman if that's what I'm looking for. I can find pornography very easily. Whatever it is that is my addiction of choice, my personal struggle, whatever that is, I can find it. That's not hard. I've talked to people that have been addicted to drugs in the past, and I've asked them the question, if you walk into a city where you've never been, how long would it take you to find illegal drugs on the street? And they say, oh, probably an hour. And they don't even know anybody. I mean, it's not hard to find something. And in the sexual realm, it's especially easy because it's already up in my head. And so it's always free cheese. It's always attractive until it's not. And then it always snaps. And there's never been a mouse that has ever gone for the cheese in a mouse trap who ever looked back, was interviewed the next day, and said that was a good idea. Every mouse that was ever interviewed after the mousetrap experience said probably shouldn't have done that. So that's how addiction is. It's very attractive, or we wouldn't do it. But I've never looked back after acting out, nor have I known anyone who did, who said that was a good idea. The cheese is free, but it's a trap.
That's good. In rule number 22, you're dealing with a subject that is going to be common to any person that gets into recovery. And you say that relapse is not an event, but a process. What do you mean by that?
Every relapse is the predictable outcome of a series of bad choices. So when someone in one of my groups says, I had a relapse Tuesday, I don't always do this, but I often will say, no, you didn't. And they'll say, no, I'm pretty sure I did. And I will say, I understand what you're saying. You did A, B, or C. I understand what you did. But the relapse was a process. It started when you missed meetings. It started when you missed your therapy session. It started when you didn't have your quiet time. It started when you missed church. It started when you missed Jonathan's broadcast last week. You should always listen to every podcast he ever does. When you miss those things, when you aren't working your program, when you have those not making the calls, not going to meet, when all those things are falling through in a very slow way, you don't even realize it's happening. But it's like the frog in the water that you heat it up until he dies. It's a long process. Relapse doesn't just happen. It's always the result of a series of bad choices.
Yeah, and I like that because it's only the last decision that feels sudden, right? Yes. Oh my goodness, I can't believe I acted out again. Or how did I end up in this hotel room or what? It only feels like that last decision makes it feel like it's sudden. But what you're saying is there's lots of other little decisions up to that point.
Yeah, and it used to frustrate me in my acting out life because I would always think, gosh, why did I do it then? But if I would ever look back at it, I would recognize that it wasn't that. I mean, that was inevitable. It's like I say sometimes to do these things like missing meetings and not making calls and not doing recovery work, lusting, which ASA says that's really the definition of sobriety, is progressive victory over lust. For me to think that I can lust and I can miss meetings and I cannot do my program without having relapsed would be like thinking I can jump off a building without hitting the ground. It's going to happen, and it's going to end badly. The problem wasn't that I hit the ground. That's never the problem. The problem is that I left the building. And so it's those little things that we do that don't seem big, but they add up.
Yeah, so I like rule number 34. I think this is a really important one to know. You say that direction trumps destination. Talk about that.
Well, I'm all about goals, and I'm reaching into my drawer right now to pull out my iClick sobriety chips. That's one I got last week. And so that's great. I mean, I want guys to have that. That's fantastic. But the thing is that we never quite get to the ultimate goal in recovery. It's a long process. It has no end. And so when we think in terms of destination, I can get to a place where I arrive. It just doesn't happen because there is no diploma here. There's no grade at the end of the day. It's all about direction. So I'm not nearly as interested in someone's sobriety date, how long they've been, quote, sober, as I am the direction they're going. Because if I'm going in the right direction, the destination will take care of itself. My goal is not to be sober for a year or 5 years or 10 years. My goal isn't even to be sober today. My goal is to do the right thing right now. And if I'm going in the right direction and I keep going in the right direction, it's going to take care of itself. When I drive from Florida to Texas, I only have to do two things. I have to find Interstate 10 and then I have to stay on it and the rest will take care of itself. And if I can do that, I don't have to worry about if I'm in the panhandle of Florida or Alabama or Mississippi or Louisiana or East. I'm going to end up in San Antonio if I just go the right direction. But when I get off the road at any point, that's when I'm in trouble. So it's all about going in the right direction, doing the things that keep me focused, going the right way, and forgetting about arriving.
Yeah. And what I love about that one in particular is it also is basically saying a really important truth, and that is, the man who is in recovery, the man who is actually learning and growing and maturing, is always in motion. There's not a sense in which you ever arrive. You're always, there's a motion that's happening to your life. There's a rhythm to it that's always going. And I think that's really good.
Absolutely.
You also say, rule number 74, you say that every shortcut is a dead end. Why is that true?
Everybody wants a shortcut. You know, if I can just go to this one intensive and be done with it, if I can just read this one book or go to this one meeting, one therapist, I want to rush through it. If I'm going to work the 12 steps, I want to do it in a very short amount of time. I just want to get it done. Just show me the short way to do it. Everyone wants to lose 10 pounds today. They don't want to do it over 3 months. Everybody wants to get in shape today. Everybody wants to have their diploma today. Nobody wants to play the long game. When I cook dinner, it always comes down to two things. Is it going to be the microwave dinner that I have to punch holes in and peel back 2 minutes later and put it back in? Or is it the one I can just leave and not have to touch it again? Because we think that way. We microwave everything. But shortcuts don't work. It's not the strategy of recovery that matters. It's the longitude. It's the fact that you're doing it for the long game. It's just that you're doing it. It's not that you found the right plan. It's that you're doing a plan. It's the best meeting to go to is the one that you actually go to. And so staying in the game and not trying to get there overnight, it's not a quick fix. You don't take a brain that's been wired a certain way for decades and just flip a switch and say, okay, I don't have those compulsions anymore. It's a long game. And that's why surrender comes in is so important. It's a daily thing. Jesus said, pick up your cross and follow me daily. He didn't say do it once and be done with it. So it is a long journey. There's just no other way to do it.
So the last one that I want to highlight before we wrap up, and you've touched on it in various ways in some of your comments previously, but that's rule number 11. And you say, don't commit to a lifetime, commit to a day. Why is that crucial as we kind of land the plane on this whole topic of recovery rules?
One of the things that I say that I think has got me in more trouble than anything, but it really comes from my wife, Beth, is I never make a commitment that I'll never act out again to my wife. I just say it won't happen today. And the reason for that is I said it the other way for 30 years and I never kept that promise because I can't control tomorrow and next week and next month. That's too big for me. I can't see it. I don't know what's coming. I don't know what's there. But it's a funny thing. If I stay sober every day, one day at a time, the years take care of themselves. And so I've determined to commit, and I lead other guys to do the same thing, commit to the one day that you have. Until God promises you tomorrow, don't make promises about tomorrow. So I'm not going to make promises of what I'm going to do on a day that God has not promised to give me. Now, that's hard to take sometimes because you want people to say, yeah, I'm never going to act out again. And of course, that's my goal. I mean, that should be everybody's goal. Absolutely. But at the same time, I've got to live in today. I can only do what I can do today. And then tomorrow I'll get up and I'll do it again. It works.
That's so good. Well, Mark, this has been a great conversation. We've only scratched the surface on the 100 recovery rules that you've written. Share with our listeners and viewers where they can go to get a copy of this book and also learn more about your ministry.
It's on Amazon, so you can always find it there, Recovery Rules, 100 Truisms That Will Change Everything by Mark Dennison, or through the resource page at our website, theresstillhope.org. And please feel free to reach out to me directly, Mark at theresstillhope.org. If you're interested in any of our groups that we do for men, for women, for couples, would love to help you with that. Please don't hesitate to reach out. We want to help in any way that we can. And I got to say again, Jonathan, thank you so much for your ministry, for mentoring me and so many others like us. You've made such a difference, not just with Be Broken. I mean, that's life-changing. I mean, you're changing the world. But more than that, guys like me that come along that you have impacted, that are impacting others. Everyone that we reach and help is a testament to your faithfulness. And I just want to thank you for that again.
Well, thank you, Mark. That definitely blesses me. And as I learned from my own mentor and coach, Steve Cervantes, I received that. So thank you for that. And as always, it's been a great conversation, Mark. Thank you for being here and for doing what you're doing. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, listeners, our desire is always to help you take your next best step on your journey towards wholeness in Christ. And so we're going to put all the information about Mark's book and their resources into our show notes. So please check all that out and reach out to us. We want to help you, again, take that next best step. And we're always glad that you're with us. And we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.
Pure Sex Radio is paid for by Be Broken Ministries. Visit us online at puresexradio.com.